Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't after you. Joseph Heller wrote that in Catch 22, and while the book is a work of satire, that line expresses something very real that explains in part why it is so easy to believe in conspiracy theories. You may understand that QAnon stuff is all a hoax, that Monsanto is not plotting to put small farmers out of business, and the vaccines are, in fact, safe and effective for just about everybody. But it's not like some conspiracies aren't real, right? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There was the one that killed Abraham Lincoln, and the concerted effort by tobacco companies to keep people from learning how much evidence demonstrated the links between smoking and cancer. What we need are some tools to see whether our own beliefs hold up to objective scrutiny, and then some tools for showing people we care about that they have fallen for some serious nonsense. Michael Shermer is founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, host of the Michael Shermer Show podcast, and a presidential fellow at Chapman University, where he teaches a course called Skepticism 101. His book is called Conspiracy: Why the Rational Believe the Irrational. Michael, welcome to Think.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me.
There are lots of reasons we can find ourselves drawn into believing some powerful puppet master is pulling the strings to control the world, not least of which is that such a theory can ironically give us back a sense of control, right? A story that explains the things we find upsetting.
Yes, right. In a way, conspiracy theories are theories of causality. Why are things happening the way that they are? And our minds did not evolve to grasp randomness and chaos, which often rules the world. So we tend to find patterns. I call this patternicity, the tendency to find meaningful patterns in both meaningful and meaningless noise. So it's a signal detection problem, which patterns that we perceive are real and which are not. And it's often hard to tell. And with conspiracies, there are conspiracies, right? By definition, two or more people plotting in secret to gain an unfair, illegal, or immoral advantage over somebody else happens all the time in politics and business. So there's a kind of form of rationality to being at least moderately paranoid or constructively conspiratorial, as I call it.
What is the difference between paranoid and realistic conspiracy theories?
Well, there it's a matter of degree, you know, kind of on a spectrum, much like, you know, what's an addiction? Well, if it ruins your life, if it rules your life and it sent you down a rabbit hole, then that's, you know, that interferes with your family, your career and job and so on. That's probably paranoia. And, you know, wrapped up in beliefs that, you know, you're more important than you really are, or people are really talking about you when they're not, that sort of thing drifts into paranoia. You know, I've encountered people in writing about QAnon and the Pizzagate and the rigged election and all that, who gave up their lives, their careers. I found one woman who even got an ultimatum from her husband. They had two kids living in Dallas. She had a PR firm and very successful, attractive, educated woman, and just decided saving the world from these pedophile satanic rings being run out of pizzerias was going to be the most important thing she ever did. And to the point where her husband gave her an ultimatum: it's us or QAnon. And she chose QAnon for a while anyway, and then she came to her senses. But that's not unusual. You know, we know from the analysis of the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, these were not tinfoil hat wearing wackadoodle weirdos in their parents' basement. No, these were normal people. So why did they do that? Because they believed it. They believed the conspiracy theory that the election was rigged, democracy's being stolen, and people act on their beliefs that they hold.
The facts claimed by QAnon, including the idea that, like, Tom Hanks and Hillary Clinton and Beyonce are all direct participants in this global child pedophilia ring, they sound patently ridiculous on the face of things. But you remind us that buying into those ideas gives people a kind of ticket into a community where they can expect to find support and acceptance regardless of who they are or where they come from. You just have to believe. And this is what you call tribal conspiracism?
Yes, exactly. It's a signal, a social signal. Sometimes it's called virtue signaling, in which you're signaling publicly to your fellow tribe members, I am so devoted to our group, this could be a political party or religion or whatever, that I'm willing to publicly state my belief in this patently ridiculous idea again, the Pizzagate is about as crazy as you can get. You know, is it, you know, does anybody really believe that Hillary Clinton is running a secret satanic pedophile ring out of a pizzeria? Well, one guy did. Edgar Welch, he went there with his AR-15 style gun and shot up the place. No one was hurt. He went to prison and later confessed that it was the dumbest thing he'd ever did. But he left a, you know, 3.5 hour drive from his home to this pizzeria place, this Comet Ping Pong Pizzeria, in which he made a video for his daughters. Yeah, he had kids, right? And he left him this message, you know, I'm going in. This is it. This is my moment. You know, there's a crime being committed. No one's doing anything about it. I'm going to do something about it. Right, so it gives people a sense of engagement, special knowledge, inside information, and if you feel out of control, which most of us do, most of us don't have much power. It feels like you're gaining power and control over this kind of chaotic world in which things seem to be happening without my knowledge or consent, and you know that's one of the drivers.
We do also, I've been thinking about our literature and our movies and our TV shows. We love stories about, you know, the lone person who recognizes that something terrible is happening and stands up to these impossibly large forces. We have a lot of hero stories wrapped around stuff like this.
It is, right. It's a little bit of the, you know, Joseph Campbell, like hero with a thousand faces, the hero's journey. I'm going out, I'm going to do this great thing, and then I'm coming back and I'll have be a changed person and make the world a better place and so on. And conspiracy theories are often along those lines. Like I have this inside information that no one else has, or our group does have this inside track. And it's not only engaging, it's often entertaining. Right? I mean, I think Alex Jones is about as far out there as you can get, but he's funny. He's entertaining. It's like a train wreck. You can't stop watching. And so I think for a lot of people, most of us, most of our lives are just kind of mundane. We just get up, go to work, take the kids to school, you know, keep gas in the tank and food on the table. And there's not much terribly exciting about it. It's just kind of normal life. And so when you get thrust with these ideas, like, oh my God, this is incredible. You mean this is that the Illuminati is going on? 9/11 was an inside job. Whoa. Obama wasn't born in the United States. This whole thing was illegal. You know, Biden is an illegal president and something, you know, something huge is going to happen. The storm is going to happen and Trump will be back in the White House. Oh my God, I can't wait to watch this. And it does engage people's emotions that way.
I really appreciated that you brought up the entertainment factor, which is not to say people necessarily get caught up in this stuff because they're just looking for something fun. They may go into it believing there is serious justification for these beliefs, but then becoming a little bit obsessed and tracking down all these alternative facts, it does kind of give not just, it's not just a time filler. I would imagine for some people, it feels like it gives some meaning to their lives.
Yes, exactly right. So we are a moralistic species, right? We have a sense of right and wrong and justice and fairness, and we want that. We know that from crime blotters, for example, most homicides, about 80 to 90% of homicides, are moralistic in nature. You know, that this other person I killed deserved it because here's what he did. And, you know, this is the case for, you know, all these protests, the BLM movement and the Me Too movement and so on. People are engaged. They want to do something. Now, the trans movement, it just these sorts of social issues engage our moral sense. And most of us can't do much of anything about big, huge movements like civil rights and so on, or the BLM movement, you know, what police brutality. What can I do about it? I'm just a regular citizen. You know, I'm not a police chief. I'm not a mayor or governor. But I can go down tomorrow and march and protest, and I'm gonna get out there and do it. And you know, a conspiracy theory kind of engages us to do that. Again, back to the January 6th insurrection. You know, most of those people absolutely believed it. Maybe some of them were there just for fun. You know, the ones that were in the Capitol Dome taking selfies. I'm not sure what they were thinking they were gonna do there. But a lot of them, the ones that came with body armor and plastic ties to arrest Nancy Pelosi and the rest and hang Mike Pence and so on, they believed it absolutely. I have no doubt they weren't crisis actors. You know, they weren't just there for the entertainment purposes. They were morally engaged. I mean, they believed what the boss told them, that the election was stolen, and they were going to go there to do something about it. What that was is not clear, but you know, you could see it in their faces, you could hear it in their voices, and yeah, it's scary.
You know, you mentioned Nancy Pelosi, and of course, she was one of the targets of the January 6th insurrection. Just recently, you know, her husband was attacked because he was home in San Francisco and she was in the Capitol. Her security detail travels with her. All to say, it's not just crackpot thinking that some people engage in that we might find annoying. There can be real life consequences, and they can bring people into these consequences who are sort of engaging in this violence, which is to say people who think they're doing the right thing but get caught up in like a really bad system of ideas.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, regarding cults, for example, I've written about that. In as I say it, no one in the history of the world has ever joined a cult. They join a group that they think is doing good. It's going to help me. It's going to save society. It's going to, you know, man the soup kitchens. We're going to help poor people, whatever the group is. You know, no one joined Jonestown to drink the Kool-Aid, right? They joined this group, to pick the most obvious example. You know, Jim Jones was a real, what we would today call a social justice warrior in the Bay Area of California when Jerry Brown was governor. You know, he had one of the first racially integrated churches in the Bay Area, and he was helping a lot of poor people and homeless people and manning the soup kitchens and so on. People join because it's like, oh my God, this is a great group, you know. And then 15 years later, you find yourself in Guyana drinking the Kool-Aid. It's like, what went wrong? Well, it happened slow enough that you don't see the gradual, incremental, you know, down the rabbit hole pathway people that you're going. And that's what happens with conspiracy theories. Usually they take a while to develop. And when we know from studies on, you know, people that go online and they start reading these things, it takes a while. Like the woman I mentioned in Dallas, you know, she said during COVID-19 shutdown, and her company was largely done, you know, she had nothing to do. So she's bored at home and the kids are off at school. So she's reading all these QAnon posts, and, you know, weeks, months later, you know, it's like, oh my God, I've discovered this horrible thing going on, the deep state, and Trump's going to put a stop to the deep state and the pedophilia ring and so on. And it just engages people in that sense.
What is proxy conspiracism?
So there I'm talking about that the specific conspiracy theory is probably a stand-in or proxy for something deeper that concerns people. So, for example, to use the Pizzagate one, if I took you to the Comet Ping Pong Pizzeria and showed you there's no pedophile ring here. Look, there's not even a basement. There's just people standing around eating pizza. It's not like the people that were worried about that would then say, oh, in that case, I'll vote for Hillary. They were never going to vote for Hillary. They don't trust Hillary, or they don't like the Clintons, or they despise Democrats or liberals or the libtards. We're going to own the libtards, right? So the specific conspiracy theory, even if you debunk it, that's not really what's behind their beliefs. They have deeper, concerns about the other political party, and it's particularly the last 10, 15 years or so, it's become so polarized. It's you know, Democrats and Republicans. It's not just that the other party has different policies that differ from mine a little bit. You know, what's the right percentage of the upper income tax bracket, or what's the percentage of immigration we should allow? It's that, you know, they are evil. They are doing something evil. They're trying to destroy this country. You know, turn it into a socialist commune or something like this, or on the other side, destroy a democracy. And so, you know, people kind of treat it like a threat, and that really engages their moral sense.
Michael, why does political extremism, and we should say political extremism regardless of whether someone leans far right or far left, why does that make people more likely to be drawn into conspiracy theories?
Well, in this case, you know, the political party is acting like a tribe, something like a extension of our extended family and community out to the society, in which our fellow tribe members becomes like the so-called band of brothers. These are kind of faux family members. These are our people. And if anything, empathy for our fellow tribe members, which sounds good in principle, like empathy is a good thing, in fact works against us when you think about people in other tribes. Well, they're a potential threat. You know, how evil are they? They're out to get our tribe. and this is what's happened, particularly, but it's always been like that in politics, but it's more polarized. We know from research by political scientists that, you know, polarization has increased dramatically in the last 15, 20 years or so. The number of people self-identified as centrist has decreased. The number of people self-identified as far left or far right has increased by quite a bit. And we know the amount of time that politicians, senators, and congressmen spend with each other across the aisle, like on the weekends with their kids' sports games and things like that, is decreased. They go home on the weekends to fundraise for the next campaign. They listen to a lot of talk radio and television, and it polarizes them. Again, the other side is not just different from us or have different beliefs, but they're evil. They want to destroy us. They want to destroy our country. Oh, boy. Okay. So it's hard not to respond to that in an equally, you know, believing, polarized way. Like, I have to do something about this.
Aside from the politics, are there particular personality traits that are more associated with conspiracy theories than others?
Yes. Okay. So there is kind of two levels of analysis. Why do people believe conspiracy theories? There's proximate causes, and then there's ultimate causes. We've been talking about the ultimate causes, you know, proxy conspiracism and tribal conspiracism and so on. Proximately, you know, race, gender, age, education, political orientation. These are all factors, but not less for general conspiracism. Although people with more paranoid personalities are obviously more likely to be susceptible to conspiracism, but more along the lines of which conspiracies people believe. African Americans, for example, are more likely to believe conspiracy theories that, for example, the government or the CIA invented AIDS or planted crack cocaine in inner cities to harm the African American communities. White Americans are more likely to think that the government is out to cancel the Second Amendment, take away our guns, they're building FEMA camps. In of all places, these are often thought to be in Texas, which usually turn out to be just big ranches, in which, you know, the government's going to take away all your guns and put you in these FEMA camps and you'll be locked up. And so the specific things like that are driven by those different factors. Education attenuates conspiracism a little bit. That, for example, people with graduate degrees are about half as likely as people without high school diplomas to believe in conspiracy theories. But it's startling that, you know, it goes from like 40% to 20%, but that one in five Americans with graduate degrees believe conspiracy theories tells us there's something else going on here. And in fact, surveys show that everybody believes at least one conspiracy theory. If you, you know, list off, say, the top 30 conspiracy theories, everybody ticks the box for at least one of them. And sometimes they tick the box for contradictory conspiracy theories. There's a famous paper I wrote about in the book called Dead and Alive, in which the psychologist found out that people who tick the box for the believing that Princess Diana was murdered are also more likely to tick the box that she faked her death. Oh. And she's still alive with Fody Aldayad, and, you know, and Elvis and Marilyn are still alive somewhere, and, you know, this sort of thing. Well, she can't be both dead and alive. So there's something deeper going on there, which is you know, kind of a lack of trust in media sources or government agencies. When they give us a report, like the Warren Report or the 9/11 Commission report, you know, the automatic response is, I don't trust it. And you often ask people, well, did you read the Warren Report? Did you read the 9/11 Commission report? No, I don't need to read it. I already know that they lie to us. So there it's tapping something deeper inside, just kind of a lack of trust of institutions that used to be trustworthy.
And it is true that the government has lied to us, right? There are lots of cases where it's been revealed that people with a great deal of power have done some bad things that they tried to keep covered up. There was Watergate. There was the Pentagon Papers. You know, Abraham Lincoln's assassination was a true conspiracy. And you note that we are wired by evolution. When in doubt, if we can either believe something that appears threatening is threatening, we're more likely to survive if we think that rustle in the grass might be a predator than if we hang out assuming it's the wind.
Right, exactly. Again, it's back to the signal detection problem. If you picture a 2x2 grid in the upper left cell, you have conspiracy theories that are true and you signal that they are true. So you got that one right. That's called a hit. on the right cell, you have conspiracy theories that are true, and you say that they're false. So that's a miss. You missed that one. That's a type 2 error, and that's a bad one to make because, you know, it's good to recognize real conspiracy theories. This could be harmful to you or your family or your tribe. And then the bottom left, you have conspiracy theories that are false, and you signal them as true. You think it's a real conspiracy, and it's not. That's a false positive, a type 1 error. But that's a low-cost error to make. It doesn't really cost much to just assume, be a little on the paranoid side. And that's often what happens. I think my argument is that it's safer to assume a conspiracy theory is true in when it's not, because the other kind of error is costlier to make. And the problem is that we all have insufficient information most of the time to know what's really going on. Like if you just take the rigged election claims, like in Arizona, for example, or Georgia, you know, how would I know whether there was some ballot in proprietaries there going on? I wouldn't even know who to call. But, you know, of course, we have election officials who do this. So 60 Minutes last night featured this guy, a Trump-appointed lifelong Republican, voted for Trump in both elections, and he looked into it and found, you know, there were only four improper ballots. Four, not 4,000, not 40,000, like the rigged election conspiracy theorists think, just four, right? So when I hear somebody like that, I feel like, well, yeah, he's probably right, because he's motivated to find fraud if there was, and he didn't find any. So that's kind of one of the criteria. How do I know if something is true or not? Well, trusted officials that would be motivated to find something and don't, that's a good signal that there probably wasn't a real conspiracy.
Another signal is, you know, the more complex conspiracies become, the more people they are counting on to theoretically be doing their evil things. There are so many potentials there for cracks in the armor that we might assume that those are incorrect.
Right. So this is part of my conspiracy detection kit. That is, how do I know if I hear a story if the conspiracy theory is likely signaling a real conspiracy or not? Well, so here's some criteria. How many people have to be involved? Because the more people you have involved in the conspiracy theory, the less likely it is to be true. Why? Because people are incompetent. People can't keep their mouth shut. And we find out about it. I mean, usually when there's government agencies or corporations doing bad things behind closed doors, whistleblowers tell us about it. Or they know somebody who knows somebody who saw it happen, that kind of thing. Right? So if 9/11 was really an inside job, we know from WikiLeaks that we saw millions of classified documents of a lot of stuff that was really bad that our government was doing, particularly in Iraq. But there was nothing in there about 9/11 as an inside job. By the way, nothing in there about JFK, nothing in there about the fake moon landing. So if these things were really true, wouldn't there be some paper trail? There was some memo, some letter, some document, somebody told somebody something. You know, so, and then the second criteria is how many components have to come together to make the conspiracy happen. Again, the more things that have to come together at just the right time and just the right place, the less likely the theory is to be true. Just take 9/11 inside job conspiracy theory, that that World Trade Center buildings were brought down by explosive devices. Well, we all saw the planes hit the buildings. We know that happened, and we could see what floors that the buildings began to collapse on, because you could just watch the videos, and those are the floors that the planes hit. So are you telling me that in addition to the planes hitting on those floors, somehow the Bush operatives got into those World Trade Center buildings and knew ahead of time which floors the planes were going to hit, planted the explosive devices in those buildings by breaking through drywall to get to the support beams, wrap them in explosive devices? You're telling me no one noticed that? And how did they have that information? And how did this happen? You'd have to have hundreds and hundreds of people involved in this, and not one of them wants to go on 60 Minutes or write a tell-all book about how it was done, or somebody who knew somebody, you know, oh, I was dating this guy, and it turns out he was one of the operatives that was in on 9/11, and he told me all about it, and now I'm going to go on the record. Nothing like that has happened, and that is what happens when there are true conspiracies, you know, like the Volkswagen cheating the emission standards of EU. This is whistleblowers that found out about, you know, we found out about the insiders that spill the beans. You know, people can't keep their mouth shut.
Okay, before we take a couple of calls here, I just want to talk about this. You say that if a conspiracy theory cannot be falsified, It is probably false. What do you mean by that?
Right. So in science, we have to be able to falsify a hypothesis, or it's not really science. If there's no way to test it, it's just my opinion against your opinion, and there's no way to get at the truth, then there's nowhere to go with that. So with conspiracy theories, like any hypothesis, you have to ask, well, what would it take for it to be false? What, you know, if I was just talking to you and you told me you believed some conspiracy theory, I would just ask you, well, what would it take to change your mind? And if the answer is nothing, I believe this because I just believe it, regardless of the evidence, then there's nowhere to go with that. It's more like a religious doctrine or something. And oftentimes I think there's something to that. I think conspiracy theories are kind of a stand-in for religious beliefs almost. They, you know, give meaning and moral purpose and you know, it's kind of a grand narrative of what's really going on in the world. And I think there, when it comes to that, the facts are irrelevant, but we have to get back to the facts. Right. I mean, whether the 2020 election was rigged or it wasn't, if it was, that's huge. And if it wasn't, then we need to know that going forward. And we need to be able to trust our electoral process, or else we don't have a democracy. So the truth matters, very much matters.
OK, to the phones now. First up, we have James calling us from Dallas, Texas. Hi, James.
Hi. I'm just wondering why, if, as you said earlier, there are these underlying legitimate concerns underneath a lot of conspiracy theories, like some of the Pizzagate thing. Why is it that so frequently opponents of conspiracy theories, rather than engaging with those concerns, they stay on the level of disproving the facts? I feel like it's a very ineffective strategy, and it completely misses what these legitimate concerns that often underline these conspiracy theories are. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, that's a great point. This is one of the points I make in the book, is that, you know, but just countering the facts is usually not enough, because there's something deeper going on inside their minds, although the facts still matter. You know, like talking about the JFK assassination, the so-called magic bullet. You know, if you believe the magic bullet theory, that it couldn't have been one shot that went through Kennedy's neck, his back neck came out, went through Governor Connally, both through his shoulder and his leg and so forth, that if you believe that, then that does change the story. I mean, that does indicate that there's a conspiracy. But if you debunk it, then there's no need for the magic bullet. It's a single bullet theory. And I show in the book, I have a beautiful diagram exactly why, how and why one bullet could have done all that. So that does matter. But if in fact what's really going on is something, well, I discuss this, called the proportionality bias. That is, the size of a cause, a huge effect should have a sizable cause to match it. So JFK, leader of the free world, you know, taken down by who? Lee Harvey Oswald, some lone nut. That doesn't feel proportional, right? So the analogy I make is the Holocaust, one of the worst things ever happened in history. The cause of it, one of the worst political regimes in history, the Nazis. There's a balance there. Right. 9/11, you know, I hear this all the time. You're telling me 19 guys with box cutters brought down the World Trade Center building? I mean, come on. There's no way. This had to be something much bigger. Or, you know, Princess Diana, cause of death, drunk driving, speeding, wasn't wearing a seatbelt. You know? But and tens of thousands of Americans die of those causes on American highways every year. But princesses are not supposed to die like the rest of us normal people, right? So you have to add elements to it. It was the MI5 or the MI6 or the royal family or Prince Charles or Prince Philip or whoever. And we find that very common with conspiracy theories. There's, you know, that people have a kind of a bias toward looking for big causes for big effects.
Why is it that the less power and control we feel we have over our own lives, the more susceptible we might be to conspiratorial thinking?
So the idea there is that if you feel out of control or uncertain, that's where conspiracy theories fill in the gap. It's just a kind of need for causality. Again, as I mentioned at the beginning, our brains are not well wired to understand randomness. We see patterns everywhere. You know, the stars in the sky are randomly distributed, but they don't look random. They look like big and small dippers. They look like horses and scorpions and fish and so on. And, you know, if you ask people to like flip coins, heads and tails, in their mind, they picture it going like heads, tails, heads, tails, heads, tails. That's what feels random. But in fact, that's not random. Real coin flips go in long streaks, streaks of five, six, seven heads in a row or tails in a row. And that happens a lot in gambling. And people fall for that fallacy. My favorite example of this is when Steve Jobs brought out the iPod and they introduced the random shuffle feature that'll play your songs from your playlist randomly. And customers complain it's not random. Certain songs come up more than others. But that is randomness. So apparently Apple had to reprogram it to make it feel random, but it wasn't random. So when we see the dots in the sky or the, you know, the pattern that looks like a conspiracy, you got to ask yourself, could randomness be explaining this? And, you know, if you throw up a handful of pennies and they land on the ground, they will not be evenly distributed. They will be clustered. And that's the same thing with cancer clusters. There's an idea, you know, it's a kind of conspiracy theory, right? That some corporation was leaking toxic chemicals into the river or whatever, which does happen. And for epidemiologists to see a cancer cluster in various places around the country, yet they always have to ask, could that be random? Because it could be.
Michael, we've had conversations on this show before about conspiracy theory, and inevitably we hear from folks who want to know how to talk to people in their lives about their conspiracy thinking and sort of get them out from under the spell of believing what may not be true. Why is it helpful, first and foremost, to have those discussions at a time when nobody is feeling emotional?
Right. Well, that's coming up with Thanksgiving dinner and Christmas dinner. And, you know, if, you know, your weird uncle brings up the QAnon or Pizzagate or rigged election or Obama birtherism or 9/11 inside job, what do you say? Okay, part of the problem of these kind of conversations is that this person likely has a lot of detailed information about anomalies that cannot be explained by the mainstream explanation. So, you know, 9/11, well, Al-Qaeda did it. Okay, that, you know, and that's what the government tells us. Oh, you believe that? Well, what about this anomaly? What about that anomaly? How come that hijacker's passport was found on the street right off the plane with it? I mean, it had to be planted. What about the explosions that people heard? What about the puffs of smoke coming out of the windows that looked like explosive devices? What about this? What about that? So if you're not prepared with answers, that can only reinforce the person's belief. This is sometimes called the backfire effect. You're trying to counter can backfire. And so you have to go for something different, like asking a lot of questions, like, well, that's really interesting. You know, where'd you hear that? What's the source of that theory or that idea? And, you know, how credible is that source? And does anybody fact check that source? Or, you know, what would it take to change your mind? That's one of my favorites. Like, that's really interesting. It could be true. You know, there are real conspiracies. So the question is that theory matching a real conspiracy or not? How could we tell? What would it take to test it? So instead of being confrontational and saying, you know, that's just a bunch of baloney or that's nonsense, because that doesn't work. In fact, that backfires. People's the wall goes up. They don't listen to you anymore. And no one likes to be compared to Hitler and the Nazis. And that's or told that they're delusional or mentally ill to believe something. And so it helps to just kind of pay attention, be respectful, listen, ask a lot of questions, mirror back to the person what you think that they're saying. This is called steel manning rather than straw manning, where you straw man somebody's argument. You kind of restate their argument in a way that they're not really making, and then you debunk it. No, instead steel man it. Let me get this straight. Are you telling me, and then repeat what you think they said? And oftentimes I find that the person will say, no, that isn't what I'm arguing. Here's what I'm arguing. And maybe you didn't get it right, because it's hard to get it right. But maybe they, when they hear it, they think, huh, that does sound kind of crazy. Let me rephrase that argument. And they refine their own thinking. And often I find the person, even if you're right and they're wrong, they're not going to change. And they realize it. They're not going to change their mind on the spot. They're not going to go, oh, my God, that's a great point. Never mind. I take back what I said. I was completely wrong. That almost never happens. The most you can hope for is that they'll just kind of take away a few points and quietly, in the silence of their mind, think, yeah, okay, maybe I'll just quietly drop this idea and quit talking about it, because that does sound pretty crazy.
Sometimes it's maddening when we hear that people believe something or disagree with a policy, and we try to ask them why, and the only answer we get is, that's what I think. And they won't articulate their sources. Is there any way to sort of get into someone's mind when they've taken a position but don't are not even interested in really examining it?
Yes, and that's when we're really into the realm of religious truths or political truths that are not by definition testable or verifiable through facts. And a lot of conspiracy theories are like that. Again, that kind of proxy or tribal conspiracism, it's just a stand-in for something else that's deeper that you have to get into. And that's fine to get into those. Like, why do you believe, well, I don't trust governments or I don't trust corporations? You'll often hear vaccine hesitant people all of a sudden are talking about, you know, pharmaceutical companies making a lot of money. You know, well, what does that got to do with whether the vaccine works or not? It doesn't. But, you know, it's tapping into their deeper concerns. Or I don't trust the CDC or that Anthony Fauci guy. You know, he lied about the mask. So why should I believe him about something else? And you find that they just don't really trust government agencies because they have lied in the past. And I mentioned earlier, you know, how race is a proxy. Well, for African-Americans who are vaccine hesitant, you'll often hear them say something about the Tuskegee experiment. If people are not aware of that, the U.S. government's own medical institutions signed off on tracking African-American communities. This is in Tuskegee, Alabama, that had, these are men that had syphilis. And they said, well, let's just follow them and see what the results are of having syphilis, you know, medically. Even after there was a treatment, a cure for it, they refused to give them the treatment. Now, these men did not consent. They didn't even know that they were part of this experiment. And that, you know, that led to, we didn't discover this until the early 70s, that led to massive overhaul of the kind of ethics and morality of doing scientific research. But that happened, and so it's understandable why people then are a little suspicious of you know, government medical agencies giving them advice. And you know, and there's, we could go back in time to this, just take the CIA, you know, Project MK Ultra, where the CIA had a plan to close the gap between the United States and Russia, China, and North Korea of mind control, brainwashing. So they started using LSD and other psychoactive drugs on U.S. citizens without their consent or knowledge, including one Frank Olson, who was a chemist for the CIA. They secretly dosed his drink at this conference they were at with LSD, and he lost his mind, and he ended up either jumping out of a New York high rise or he was pushed by, he was murdered by the CIA. And we still don't know the answer to that, but the fact that the CIA was even doing that is astonishing. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. You know, there was the, COINTELPRO project, that is the FBI planting agents in the 60s and 70s, 50s, 60s, and 70s of social justice groups like the American Indian Movement, feminist groups, the Black Panthers, a whole bunch of other groups, including planting fake, that is putting agents in these groups to track them. And this went all the way up to the top where they tried to blackmail Martin Luther King Jr. This was, it didn't come out till the 90s. It was the FBI that sent him this letter. They sent him a letter saying, you know, we tape recorded your sexcapades with your mistresses in these hotel rooms, and we're going to make it public if you don't kill yourself, essentially what the letter said. That letter was sent to him by the FBI. So it's like, if you hear enough of these stories, you think, huh, why should I believe what they say now? Right. So when someone like Alex Jones goes off on one of his crazy rants, when you really look into it, it's like they're not completely 100% delusional. There's always some little kernel of truth in there, like the ones I just mentioned.
So no decent person could defend any of the things, the terrible indiscretions and abuses that government has committed in the past. But I even wonder sometimes about these umbrella terms. When you say the government as if it's one monolith, when you say the media as if, you know, there is one way of doing things, I wonder if that contributes to the problem. Because I think for every person who doesn't trust the government, they might have a neighbor down the street, you know, who works for Social Security or the IRS or something, and they know that person to be a decent human who's just showing up at work every day.
Yeah, exactly. They're out to get you. They don't want you to know about this. Well, who's the they, right? I mean, the government employs millions of people. Most of the time, most government agencies and most government bureaucrats and so on are just regular people just doing their job, and they're not up to no good at all. But even in the media, you know, I hear my conservative friends ranting about the New York Times and how they got this story wrong and that story wrong. Yeah, but they publish, you know, hundreds of stories a day. And, you know, most of them are fine. And, you know, same thing on the other side, you know, Wall Street Journal or you know, conservative talk radio or Fox News or whatever, you know, but most of the time the stories are fine. So we have a selection bias. We pick out the ones that stand out as incorrect and then generalize from there, you know, classic stereotyping. You just expand it to everybody in the group and just label it as one entity, you know, the government. You know, there is no such thing as the government. One of my favorite episodes of Joe Rogan's podcast, too, I was just on his show. He had Edward Snowden on, and Joe loves conspiracy theories. And Snowden says, well, let me tell you what's really going on in the NSA. Right. These are not, behind closed doors, cigarette smoking men plotting the takeover of the world. It's just bureaucrats trying to keep their jobs and trying to get a budget increase next budget season. And, you know, they have to do this and that to keep their jobs. And, you know, they're not plotting anything huge. And it's like, oh, that's boring. that's kind of like normal life. Right. So the conspiracy, back to what we were talking about before, the conspiracy theory is very entertaining. It's very exciting because it's much grander than normal life.
All right. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Matt on the line in Plano. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just got done watching a documentary on Netflix about the FLDS. I know you guys spoke about Johnstown earlier, but in the documentary, it talks about how the FLDS, which is an offshoot of the Mormon Church of Latter-day Saints, men must have as many wives as possible to reach the pearly gates of heaven. And the more wives they have, the more they'll be saved. And the women just, you know, of course, subserviently follow along with that. But some of the men decide, you know what, we're not for this. And the Messiah, who is Warren Jeffs, kicks them out. So my question is, if those men really believed what they were being taught why would they accept being kicked out? Or why wouldn't they just challenge the Messiah, which in this case was Warren Jeffs, who had tens of wives, and of course all the men had, the more wives they had, they were more saved. So why wouldn't, if they were getting kicked out, why wouldn't they just challenge the Messiah?
Thanks for
your interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting. It's more in the realm of cults than conspiracies, I guess. But, first of all, for the women, they're mostly raised as from young, the age of young girls. They don't know any different. So, are they making rational choices? You know, you see these TV shows like The Sister Wives, and, you know, these are adult women saying, hey, I like it. Yeah, but they don't know any difference. So some 12-year-old is told she's going to marry this 60-year-old guy, and she doesn't know that she could have agency and freedom, autonomy, make her own decisions. You know, they have no exposure to this. This is the danger of why it is a cult. And as for the men, well, they're punished. When they get kicked out, I mean, there's a problem in a sexually reproducing species like ours where you have, it's close to 50-50. And, so if one guy has 10 women, there's 9 guys that got none. Well, what do you do with those? Because they, you know, they want their fair share or whatever. I mean, they have their own needs and wishes. And, you know, well, they kick them out. That's what happens. And they have no choice. Or those that dissent from the FLDS, they risk losing everything that they have, including the only people they know. And, you know, that would be scary, just be kind of tossed out into the real world that you know nothing about. I don't know if you've ever been to I've been to some of these small towns in northern Arizona and southern Utah and Colorado, and they're kind of spooky places. You go through there, it's a little bit like a Twilight Zone experience. And, you know, imagine being, that's all you know, and then all of a sudden you're threatened. If you don't go along with this, you're out. You lose your family, you lose your job, you have no income, you have no savings, nothing, and often no education. And so this is very, very dangerous.
Before I let you go, is it always worth trying to engage with people in our lives that we're relatively close to if we think they believe things that are actually conspiracy theory?
I guess it depends on the cost, the importance of the relationship, and what the cost would be to challenge the person's belief. I mean, if it's a deeply held belief by which they define themselves, Like, I mean, if you're a Christian, you have pretty much have to believe that Jesus not only died, but was resurrected, came back from the dead. The whole point of being a Christian is that. So challenging somebody's core belief like that, if you don't happen to believe it, if you're Jewish or Muslim or whatever, you know, that could be threatening to a relationship. I mean, there are some marriages, I guess, where, you know, one's a Democrat, the other's a Republican, one's a Christian, one's a Muslim or an atheist. I mean, it happens, but it's harder. So I guess you have to ask yourself, you know, how important is my relationship with this person? How important is this belief? You know, and I think it's okay to have those kind of conversations, but it has to be done respectfully. You can't make fun of their beliefs, just ask questions. And the fact is, you might be wrong. I mean, it's okay to engage with other people. If for nothing else, they may actually have something worth hearing that you want to hear. They may have something they want to say that is worth your hearing, because you could be wrong, right? So behind all of this is that none of us are omniscient. I don't know everything.
We're at the end of the hour. Michael Shermer is founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, fellow at Chapman University, and author of Conspiracy: Why the Rational Believe the Irrational. Michael, this has been really interesting. Thanks for making the time to talk with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, on our website, think.kera.org. You can sign up for our brand new newsletter. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.